Believe in the Bible, believe in evolution, but don't fool yourself with the idiocy of thinking you can believe them both. The fact is, I have very logical reasons for believing in things that logic and reason cannot teach me. It's kind of ironic, but the more complexity science finds in life, the more unlikely becomes the whole scenario and theory they use to explain the origins of life. The amazing thing that quantum physics shows is that nature, at its most fundamental level, strains human credulity and belief in ways that biblical faith never does. Years ago, somebody once asked me this question. Fair enough question. He said, what would it take to get you to leave Christianity? What would it take to get me to leave Christianity, to leave believing in the Bible or the New Testament as well, to leave believing in Jesus? And I thought about it for a minute and I thought, all right. I said, convince me that God doesn't exist, okay? I mean, I think if, you know, that happened there. Now, there happen to be some professed Christians I know or have heard that don't even think there's a God, but that's another issue. I'm not going to go there. I said, convince me that God didn't exist, and boom, I'm gone. I mean, what was the sense of claiming to be a believer in Jesus and the Bible if you didn't believe that God existed? But, you know, I thought about that for a little while, and I thought, well, you know, that's pretty hard. How do you prove that God doesn't exist? So I decided to this person, I went back to him later and I said, okay, hey, let's lower the bar a little. Okay, instead of trying to convince me that God doesn't exist, I'll make it easier for you. I'll make it easier. I'll lower the bar. Convince me of a scientific fact. A fact that we're told by Richard Dawkins, the atheist evolutionist, a fact that is indubitable as, quote, that the earth goes around the sun, close quote. Convince me of this simple fact that is what is often called the neo-Darwinian synthesis. This idea that simple life started billions of years ago and began some primitive genetic replication to create the first chemicals, and then they became cells, and then there was natural selection, and over billions of years, it created Homo erectus, and then eventually humans, and on and on and on, the whole dog and pony show of evolution. I said, if you convince me that that is true, that Darwinism, or what they now call the neo-Darwinian synthesis, because so much of what Darwin said they now is they believe is wrong, so they've kind of synthesized it in a new version of Darwin with New Earth stuff. I said, convince me that that's true, and I am out of here. I am gone from Christianity. I am gone from the Bible. If evolution is true, I know that my Bible beliefs have to be false. Now, think about this for a minute. Think about this for a moment. If Darwin were even close to getting origins right, if what Darwin said is true, then God might as well have told us that the stork brings babies as to inspire Genesis 1 and 2. I mean, come on. If creation took billions and billions of years as opposed to six literal days, you know, that's only off by a factor of like 185 trillion or something like that to one, why should I believe anything the Bible says? I mean, really, God says the Bible, life was created, boom, boom, boom. Evolution says something different. If evolution is true, then why should I trust in anything in the Bible? I believe a fortune cookie from a takeout Chinese restaurant would have better odds of getting things right than would the Bible if evolution were true. I mean, let's get hypothetical. Let's get hypothetical for a moment. And let's pretend that the Genesis creation account was never meant to be taken literally. And when I mean literally, it was not meant to be taken in the sense that God created life and created the, you know, the fundamentals of this earth and the seas and all that in six literal 24-hour days. Let's say it wasn't meant to be taken that way. And then let's assume also what almost so many people today believe, or many, quote, profess to believe, let's assume that evolution were in fact true. And let's suppose, too, that God was communicating us to the work about creation, about the work of creation. Suppose the texts in Genesis were, as many theistic evolutions say, suppose they were supposed to be understood metaphorically, symbolically, nothing more. And suppose that he really did use evolution to create life on earth. Okay? Given that premise, what then was the Creator seeking to reveal to us about origins? First, let's look at some of these verses from Genesis 1. Now, listen carefully as I read them. And just listen to them. Think about what they're saying. And God said, let there be light, and there was light. And God said, let the waters under the heavens be gathered together in one place, and let the dry land appear. And it was so. And God said, let the earth bring forth grass, the herb yielding seed, and the fruit tree yielding fruit after its kind, whose seed is in itself upon the earth. And it was so. And God said, let us make man in our image after our likeness. So God created man in his own image. Now think about this. Think about what we just read. Everything, what you just read there, everything there was planned. Everything was precise. Everything was calculated, wasn't it? I mean, go back and read those texts for yourself. There was nothing random in those texts, nothing arbitrary, nothing chancy. They don't hint at any kind of chance, at any kind of error, at any kind of anything at all like natural selections, fits and stops and starts and on and on and on. It would take a very strange interpretation of Genesis 1 to somehow derive randomness out of it. Read it yourself. Go back and read it again, thinking about what I just said. Everything in Genesis, everything is planned. Nothing is even hinted at that there is anything left to chance at all. Everything is very precisely created in its time and in its place. Again, read it and ask yourself, is there anything in the texts, anything in those texts that ever even hints at randomness, that hints at anything even remotely like what we know evolution teaches? Okay, that's the first point. Second, look at these texts with me. And God created great whales and every living creature that moves, which the waters bring forth abundantly. He created them after their kind, and every winged fowl after his kind. And God said, let the earth bring forth cattle, let the earth bring forth living creatures after his kind, cattle and creeping things and beasts of the earth after his kind. And God made the beasts of the earth after his kind, and cattle after their kind, and everything that creeps, that creepeth upon the earth after his kind. Now think about this, after his kind, after their kind. The text, what does that mean? These texts reveal unambiguously that each creature was made after its own kind. I mean, the whales were made after whales, and the birds were made after birds, after its own kind. That is, each one was made separate and distinct from the others. I mean, look how clear that was. It was one that was made after this kind, that was made after its kind. Each one was clear and distinct, made differently from the other ones. Each one after its own kind. Now, even from a non, even if you wanted to take a non-literalist interpretation of Genesis, okay? And I realize that word literal is a little funky, but you know what I mean, taking a literal six-day creation. Even a non-literalist creation of literalist interpretation of Genesis, if you're going to read it even in the broadest sense, just looking for the broadest principles, not worrying about little details, but just broadly, if you take a non-literalist interpretation of Genesis, two points are very, very obvious from the text. Two points, I just don't know how, they're indisputable. And how anybody that even claims to take these texts, even with a modicum of seriousness, how they could deny it. The first point, nothing was random in the act of creation. Everything was planned, calculated, precise, in its time, in its place. So first, nothing random in the act of creation. And second, clear as obvious it could be, there was no common ancestry for the species. They didn't all start from one kind and then this branched off and this branched off with a common ancestor. No, each one was made after its own distinctive kind. Two points, nothing random and no common ancestry for the species. Each came after its own kind. Okay, and I again, read the text. I don't think I'm being arbitrary here. I think any fair reading of Genesis, any fair reading of the text at all would come, anybody reading it fairly would come to these conclusions on these two points. There's more, but I'm looking at those two. Now, what happens? Along comes Darwinian evolution, which in its various incantations, and there are many different incantations. I mean, Darwin is different types of people with different views. I mean, there are all many different understandings of evolution as there are evolutionists, sort of like Christians, but that's another matter. But anyway, now comes Darwinian evolution. And whatever the various incantations of it, it teaches two things. It teaches randomness, and it teaches a common ancestry for all species, right? I mean, isn't that anybody, any form of evolution? It's random, it's chance, blah, 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 and common ancestry for all species. So how then does one interpret Genesis through a theory that at its most basic level contradicts Genesis at its most basic level? Also, think about this too. Think about this truth, because I think it's important for what it's worth. If evolution were true, it would mean that for thousands of years, from the whole Israelite period, up through the New Testament church, up through the Protestant Reformation, and then beyond the Protestant Reformation, the Lord's church was kept in darkness regarding human origins until the Lord, in his infinite wisdom, raised up his divinely appointed one, Charles Darwin. You know, an atheist, I really think Darwin towards the end became an atheist, or at best an agnostic. He raised up Darwin, of all people, to finally reveal the truth about the proper interpretation of Genesis. I mean, come on, for thousands of years or all these centuries we're in darkness, and then he brings up Darwin. You know, and believe me, by the end of his days, Darwin was an agnostic. How could he not? He had the foresight to take his premises to their logical conclusion. Now, I'm not saying that couldn't have happened. I mean, there's nothing logical with God using Charles Darwin, you know, to straighten the whole world out and the whole church out, which had been in darkness for centuries over creation. But it does seem pretty strange, does it not? And is it just coincidental? I don't know. That right about the time Charles Darwin is doing his thing, God raised up a people, a church, a movement with a specific message about God as the creator, a people whose foundation message includes these words where it says, you know, I saw another angel flying in the midst of heaven, having the eternal gospel to proclaim to those who dwell on the earth, to every nation, kindred, tongue, and people, saying with a loud voice, fear God and give glory to him, for the hour of his judgment has come, and worship him who made the heaven and the earth and the sea and the springs of water. So right at the time Darwin is doing his thing, which for many people pushed God out of the picture entirely, God raises up a people right at that time who brings them right back to Genesis, to God as the creator. How unfortunate, too, that some who profess to be members of the church that was called to proclaim these words now believe in evolution, a theory that undermines everything that the teaching about God as the creator. Believe in evolution, believe in the Bible, but don't dupe yourself into thinking you could believe in both. And that's important, too, that we shouldn't judge anyone in the 19th century by our standards today. God's man Darwin held some pretty hard racist views. Even worse, thanks to Darwin and his theory of human descent, racism now had been given a scientific rationale. You know, I can remember many years ago, I took a trip to the Dachau, the concentration camp in Germany, the first one that the Nazis had opened. They didn't hide it. They put it in the newspaper that Dachau was open. And I remember what was fascinating was that the tour guide began his tour of Dachau by talking about the theories of Charles Darwin. And the point was Darwin's theories were used to help bring about the kind of, quote, scientific racial views that ultimately led to the Holocaust. It's interesting, too, that many of Darwin's teachings, basic teachings, are rejected by evolutionists today. Even Richard Dawkins, who's kind of the most prolific and most well-known atheist apology, once wrote, quote, "Much of what Darwin said is in detail wrong." So think about this for a minute. If evolution were true, then the Lord used an agnostic with racist tendencies, with detailed errors in his teachings, as the divinely appointed one to finally set the church right and straight on the book of Genesis and our origins? I don't know. Anyway, there's more. Let me read you from Darwin, because contrary to popular views, Charles Darwin worked from a theological premise. Darwin said, "There seems to me too much misery in the world. I cannot persuade myself that a beneficent and omnipotent God would have designed and created," it's a fancy word, but we'll call it the parasitic wasp, "with the express intention of their feeding within the living bodies of caterpillars, or that the cat should play with mice." Okay. Of course, if you understand a beneficent and omnipotent God, quote, did none of these things, thus ignorant of the great controversy, ignorant of the consequences of the fall, Darwin began from a fatally long premise about the creation he sought to explain. Don't miss this point. Darwin developed his theory at the most foundational level on a radically faulty premise. Now, in logic, if you start out with a false premise, then no matter how flawless your logic, you've got a very good chance of winding up in a false place. Doesn't have to happen that way, but it sure makes it more likely. And so we have Darwin working on the false assumption that the violence and predation we see in nature was how the Lord created it. Then he builds a theory based on that false premise. Something to think about. Anyway, here's Darwin again. He wrote, "But I gradually came by this time to see that the Old Testament, from its manifestly false history of the world, was no more to be trusted than the sacred books of the Hindus or the beliefs of any barbarian." Huh. This was God's appointed vehicle to reveal to humanity the truth of our origins? Oh, doesn't make sense to me. But there's more, too. You know, people say, I've ever heard it said that people say that the ancients couldn't understand something like evolution, so the Lord had to frame it, you know, in simple ways so these ignorant primitives, you know, c- could understand it. And not till the 19th century were we smart enough, were we advanced enough to be able to understand it. Oh, that's the idea, that they were too dumb back then. But you know, that's not true. Concepts similar to evolution were known in the old world. You can read in ancient sources. I mean, have you ever read Lucretius and his work? Here's a guy who lived before Christ. He wrote a book called On the Nature of Things. And here's a guy 2,000 years ago pretty much pushing evolution. God didn't have to dumb it down for the ancients. The Lord could have revealed truth to them and us instead of promulgating a fairy tale, one that hardly parallels the model of the Bible anyway. Billions of years of false starts, chance events, and endless death allegorized as a six-day pre-planned creation, nothing left to chance, and no death. Please, in such a scenario, God's word becomes satire and very untrustworthy. Plus, two, the seventh-day Sabbath and memorial of a six-day of a creation that instead of taking 6 days took aeons. Come on. We might as well pay homage to the stork. You know, think about it too. The worst thing about evolution is what it does to the cross and the whole plan of salvation. Think about this. Think about this here for a minute. The Lord incarnates into an evolved ape created through the vicious and painful murderous cycle of natural selection, all in order to abolish death, the Bible says, the last enemy. But how can death be the enemy when death itself was one of God's chosen means for creating human? In evolution, death is a crucial and necessary component in the survival of the fittest model. You know, the Lord must have expended plenty of dead Homo erectus, Homo heidelbergensis, and Homo neanderthalus in order to finally get one in his own image, Homo sapiens. I mean, it's ludicrous. Jesus comes to save mankind from the very process God used to create mankind in the first place. Go figure. It doesn't make sense. Then there's what's been called the altruism problem, one that troubles even atheistic evolutionists, much less those who believe throw a loving God in the mix. If this vicious dog-eat-dog process of natural selection, in which the strong overpower the weak, were the mean by which we came into existence, then why should we do differently? Are we not following God and the dictates of nature as He ordained it when we advance our own interests at the expense of the less naturally selected? In an evolutionary paradigm, we should eliminate the weak, making ways for those who are already closer to the image of God, the process for which all this pain and suffering was ultimately to lead to. You know, I still remember one theologian argued once that animals don't really feel pain. Imagine that. I don't know. I got a dog, and I can tell you animals feel pain. But that was a mind-bogglingly brilliant attempt to get God off the hook for all the sufferings that evolution entails. I guess in the end, the bottom line is Homo erectus didn't become Homo sapiens by following the golden rule. And if they didn't, why should we? Now, evolutionists, of course, have come up with all sorts of speculative theories about why altruism would have evolved, though it does seem kind of strange for a god to use a process of violence, the strong crushing the weak and so forth, all in order to evolve beings who are supposed to love their enemies and give their lives for others. I don't know. It seems kind of strange, does it not? And then there's the fall. The fall. How does this work? How does this work? God uses a process of violence, selfishness, and dominance of the strong against the weak in order to create a morally flawless and selfless being who falls into a state of violence, selfishness, and dominance of the strong over the weak, a state from which he has to be redeemed or else face final punishment? I mean, we commit sin when we do the very thing God ordained that needed to be done in order to exist. I don't know about you, but that makes perfect sense. Come on, it's ludicrous. In the evolutionary paradigm, too, eschatology, end time things, becomes interesting as well, especially God's promise to make the new heaven and a new earth. Look at this text. For behold, I create a new heavens and a new earth, and the former shall not be remembered nor come into mind. And therefore, as a new heavens and a new earth which I make shall remain before me, so shall the seed in your name remain, and on and on. There are a number of texts like that. Now, this is the question. Will this new heaven and new earth be created by divine fiat? God speaks and it is? Something similar to what happened in Genesis? Or will life again endure the rigors and joys of natural selection and survival of the fittest for billions of years until a new world, one wherein dwelleth righteousness, finally appears? I mean, if God used billions of years to create the world first time, with the vicious and violent process of evolution as the means to do it, if he did that the first time, why doesn't he do it that way the second? Or could he instantly creates life and resurrects people from the dead and so on? Why did he do that? Why didn't he do that way the first time and save everybody the joys of evolution? But people, okay, you say these arguments are fine, Cliff. But people say it's science. Science proves it. Evolution is proved by science. Really? Well, to me, the answer is very, very, very simple. It boils down to this. The science is wrong. That's all there is to it. If you've been watching these shows, I've dealt with this before. It's not the first time that science is wrong, and it won't be the last time science is wrong. I mean, scientists today struggle. Take something like quantum physics and general relativity, two very highly proven teachings, things that can make incredible predictions, and yet at some levels, these things basically contradict each other. Quantum theory itself is filled with all sorts of questions and challenges and things that people don't understand. So we're going to get dogmatic about what supposedly happened to some strand of DNA 400 million years ago in some shallow pool in Africa when we're still struggling with some of the most basic teachings of science today? I imagine that if we were to take a closer look at some of the evidence for evolution, I mean, really get to the utter foundations, I think people would be surprised at just how much speculation, guesswork, and leaps of faith are involved in the whole process. The bottom line, I could be mocked, I can be derided as a creationist, and on and on and on. I don't care. The Word of God is too plain and too clear. Choose the God of Charles Darwin, or choose the God of the Bible. But let's not fool ourselves into thinking that you could somehow serve both, that you could somehow meld them together, because you can't. If evolution is true, the Bible is false, there's no middle ground, no way to get around that.